Welcome to the latest episode of Mountain Voices, the podcast series from the International Climbing and Mountaineering Federation, the UIAA. I'm Tarquin Cooper. With the season about to kick off, this pod is all about Everest and the wider climbing and trekking scene in Nepal.
Voici un embouteillage d'alpinistes sur l'Everest le 23 mai 2019.
Take a look at this picture. That is a literal human traffic jam.
Everest is more than 200 kilometers from the earthquake epicenter, but still the tremor has caused the worst disaster ever on the mountain.
Con i suoi 8849 metri di altitudine, l'Everest rappresentava un tempo l'ultima grande sfida dell'esplorazione.
This is the line of people waiting to reach the summit of Mount Everest. One mountain guide says difficult weather conditions and a lack of experience is contributing to this.
I'm delighted to be joined by three hugely respected figures in mountaineering. Ed Douglas is the author of numerous books on Everest and the Himalayan region, including the biography of Tenzing Norgay, Chomolungma Sings the Blues, Travels Round Everest, and Himalaya, A Human History. Victor Saunders is a UIA GM guide who's led numerous ascents around the world. His first ascents include Panchachuli 5 and Golden Spiller of Spantik. His most recent was Sursank in 2016. His books have won prizes in Canada, France, and England. He's a former president of the Alpine Club and has made 6 ascents of Mount Everest. Younghoon Oh is a Korean climber and anthropologist. He's made 4 attempts on Mount Everest, 3 of which were to do with his ethnographic research, and he summited in 2012. He's also lived among the Nepali for 2 years, and he's a contributory author of Other Everests, One Mountain, Many Worlds, a scholarly book published this November. We should also say Victor and Younghoon are both members of the UIAA Mountaineering Commission, which promotes best practices and provides guidance on all mountaineering issues. Welcome to you all.
Hi there, Tarquin.
Great to meet you guys.
Great to have you here. So this year's the 100th anniversary of Mallory and Irving's fated last climb on Mount Everest, sparking up 100-year question of did they or didn't they? Now, if they've come to define that heroic period of exploration with their experimental oxygen sets and, by our standards, primitive clothing, what would define the present age? Is it the age of commercialization? If you were to ask the average member of the public to describe Everest, they would probably think of that photo by Nims Perger in 2019, the long queue of hundreds of climbers all clipped into a fixed rope going up the Hillary Step. We all know the stories, clients who can't climb, who don't know how to use an ice axe or crampons, blindly sliding a Jumar up a rope fixed by teams of Sherpa. But what is the true picture? Is Everest despoiled by commercialization and the trash, the human waste? Or can it still be a worthy objective and a proper achievement and an ethical achievement that leaves behind little environmental footprint where porters are paid fairly and treated well and everyone's happy? Who wants to jump in first? Younghoon, you've climbed Everest, you've studied the region. What's your view on the Everest scene? Is the popular view right?
From my point of view, it's not right. First of all, the expression itself, the term commercialization or commercialism, I don't think the definition, if you want to define what's going on Mount Everest today as commercialism, I think you cannot make a 100% definition who can be agreed by everyone. In other words, if you consider the history of modern mountaineering or history of alpinism, there is no single event where there is money is not involved. For example, like the first ascent of Mont Blanc, I mean, that was done for the aim of the money, right? And also the actual popularization of the alpinism in the European countries, especially beginning in the middle of the 19th century in the Europe, in England, you know, there was like the historic figure named by Albert Smith, his series of shows and lectures in his own, the travels to the Mont Blanc, which became so popular, the alpine climbing so popular around the general public in the UK. And also, that, for example, in the 1920s, the first Everest expeditions by the British people, there are a lot of publicization about that expedition in the within the context of the England, that sometimes they brought the Tibetan Lamas to be on the stage to make some money, right? And also, some historians say the first commercial expedition is actually first commercial expedition to Mount Everest is actually 1975 British Everest Southwest based expedition.
I think that was the one where there were questions in Parliament, weren't there? When Bonington was he was asking Barclays Bank is getting sponsored by them, and yes, there was in the midst of a recession.
Yeah, really. So all in all, I mean, what I'm saying is, when we call the what's going on Mount Everest today as commercialism, I think we need that calling itself, that naming itself, tells a lot more than us, than what they are doing over there. I am reluctant to use that term. So, I mean, we don't call the guiding practices on Denali or the Mont Blanc as commercialism, right? And why then we call commercialism on the what's going on Mount Everest? So I'd rather like to call them as guided expedition or pre-organized expedition. You know, the guided expedition began in the early 1990s on Mount Everest, and until around 2010, you know, it was more about the sort of the dual system where in the foreign countries, people, the mountaineers organized their own team, and they arrived in Kathmandu and they reorganized their team expedition with the local population. And so it's like a dual system, which changed recently in the middle of the 2010s. It is a crucial change, but it is, if you look at the scope of climbing practices of Mount Everest, it's a slight change. So the terminology of commercialism itself is probably, there's a tint of pejorative perception of what's going on.
Thanks, Younghoon. But Ed, would you agree that to some extent, all climbing has had an element of commercialism throughout the years?
Not altogether. I mean, I very much take Young's points. He's right. You know, first ascent of Mont Blanc, Albert Smith, who made absolute fortune. He used to appear nightly or however many times a day at the Egyptian Hall in Piccadilly and made a fortune. Out of his one ascent of Mont Blanc. So yes, commercialism has always been with us, or making money out of climbing has always been with us. We do get very misty-eyed about the 1920s expeditions, but they cost money. They cost a lot of money, and the money had to be raised, and there was a real fight about how commercial to make those expeditions. There was a lot of reluctance on the part of some to get involved in all of that. But it's an expensive business. Climbing, mountaineering is an expensive hobby, and you have to fund it. I think possibly where I would part company is on how Everest is perceived. It's become a prestige good. It's prestige goods. You know, it's like a Ferrari or a very expensive watch. It's a symbol of something. It's a symbol of kind of success. You know, that you can afford to do this, because not everybody can. I can't. If I had a spare 60 or 70 grand, I possibly wouldn't be spending it on climbing Everest. I might be spending
it on... Unless you gave it to me.
I might give it to you, because you desperately need it. But I'd pay down the mortgage first. Or I'd spend...
What if they gave you a free ticket on a victim?
Yeah, I would do it, Yeah, I would do that. Yeah, I'm getting a bit too old now, but yes, I would do that. So I very much understand that kind of, that dichotomy, if you like. It's complicated. I think commercialism is a shorthand, really, for a badly managed mountain. And there are aspects of climbing on Everest which are clearly not great. You know, when people are so anxious about the amount of human shit on the mountain, then there's a problem. I mean, it's pretty unarguable, it seems to me. But that's a different thing from climbing for money. I mean, you look at Khumbu, you see the numbers for its economy, and it's clear that it's made a colossal difference to people's lifestyles. It's allowed the Sherpas to become some of them, not all of them by any means, but some of them to become very wealthy. And wealth creation in my book is morally positive, so that's good. But I don't, so for me, the word commercialism, I mean, Jung is right, it's pejorative, but I think it expresses people's anxieties about the poor management of the mountains.
And broadly, I mean, you've been reporting on Mount Everest and writing about the region for 30 plus years. What's your sort of observation of that period? I mean, we all remember the 1996 disaster that sort of put kind of the, if you like, the bad management on the, in the public imagination. What's changed? Has anything changed, or is it just more of the same since then?
That's a good question. I mean, you're right. I was actually there in 1996. I sort of met Scott Fisher, who was walking in at the time. I had sort of conversations with him about what was going on. You know, I met a lot of the people involved in that, and I interviewed some of them afterwards, including I went to Dallas to talk to Beck Weathers. So I became an Everest hound by accident more than anything, just because I was there and it was like a big story at the time. And, you know, I was a working journalist, and like that's, I have to say, my passion for this subject has waned over the years. And I think partly because it is more of the same. I mean, the great lessons, you know, from that expedition were just more of everything, more oxygen, more rope, more Sherpas, make it safer. I think things have, you know, I think in terms of weather forecasting, things have improved a great deal. And as a consequence, you know, the fatality rate has fallen, even though we've had some very bad years. The one thread through all of this that has not changed the same is a kind of lack of administration from central government. They're very happy to take the money. They're very happy to protect the golden goose, to the extent that people keep coming, but what they won't do is think seriously about how to manage the mountain better. And until that happens, I think things will just continue as they are.
Yeah. Is there anything in your mind that would lead to better management of the mountain? What would you see as needing to be done?
I mean, it's tricky. Victor will have strong views on this, I think, because he's an actual mountain guide and has climbed it, whereas I'm just a journalist who knows nothing. But, you know, it's been interesting to see sort of comments from various kind of quite serious-minded Sherpas about the numbers on the mountain. Essentially, you know, if you're going, you know, the more people you have, the more infrastructure you're going to need to deal with some of these problems. And that's the balance between keeping it, you know, quite a wild place and sort of managing the impact of those numbers. I mean, the other great change in recent years over the last decade or so has been the colossal increase in helicopter flights. And that, I think, has been dismayed some people. You know, the thing's turned into a kind of, you know, the Khumbu Glacier as a landing strip is you know, a little disheartening, I suppose. But you know, that's the balance. You know, how many people, how much stuff, how much income, and how much environmental impact, and finding the sweet spot in all of that is the thing that has to happen. And until it's properly regulated, it won't.
Now seems a good time to bring in Victor. You're an interesting one because you ride two horses in this debate, as it were. You've been an Everest guide, but obviously you've also led many first ascents in that classic Alpine style. What's your readout of the situation on Everest? What's your feeling?
It's complicated. Before going on to talk about which was something I'm really concerned about, there's a couple of things I'd like to say first.
Sure.
First of all, Young Hoon, the first ascent of Mont Blanc was only 50% commercial, and that was Balmat. Packard was not interested in money. He was only okay. Climbing. So I just like to pick up the history. And that goes all the way through.
Good point.
Even in 1924, Mallory was having arguments about how to monetize his expedition. He wanted to write about it, and there were and he had problems with the contract for that. And the Bonington's expeditions in 75, I know Chris really well. So I'm going to guess, but I'm almost certain there would have been a contract about who was going to earn money from writing from that.
There was a contract.
So it's complicated. People do climb mountains for themselves, and sometimes it's so expensive that only rich people can afford to take a non-commercial view on. That's the first thing. The second thing is the great majority of commentators and critics about what's going on in Everest have never set foot on the mountain. And I think that's interesting. I think You'll find that most of the people who've been involved in it have chosen to remain relatively quiet. I have to ask Ed and Young Hoon, how many people do you think go up the Khumbu Valley as tourists every year? Is it 30,000, 50,000?
Oh, yes. I mean, at least these days, yeah.
And so I think that in focusing on the detritus left by 300 or 400 people over 1 week summit window on Everest, it's almost inappropriate to complain about those when the amount of economic and physical and ecological damage done by tourists in the Khumbu Valley outweighs it by several factors of 10. I think that what people are doing to Everest really only concerns other mountaineers. If there's shit in the mountains, it's up to the mountaineers to sort it out themselves. 90% of people who comment on it are not those mountaineers. They will never actually see it for themselves. And it is disgusting, but it's up to them to sort it out. I think much more important is that we have completely changed the economic and social life in the big valleys like Khumbu by our presence there as tourists, as ordinary tourists. So having said all that, the thing that really interests me, of course, is this kind of discussion about style and the way in which you do things. And I think that one way to understand the very big expeditions on Everest is that they are people's personal ambitions. They're not to do with the branch of mountaineering that's to do with difficult or first ascents or different rules. It's all about the rules that you set yourselves for the climb. I mean, one set of rules for climbing Everest might be to start from the sea and only do it, go all the way to the top from the sea, walking all the way down. That's been done before. People have even set the rule of cycling from the lowest, going by human power, from the lowest point of Earth to the highest point, cycling up and then climbing. And so deciding that the rules for climbing Everest are you start at base camp and you don't helicopter to camp two or something. That's, you know, these are just changes of rules. And when you change the rules or you have different sets of rules, then you have a different branch of the sport. It doesn't make any more sense to say that the rules for climbing in Britain on those beautiful trad climbs that we have in Britain are the same as the rules you have for bouldering or for aid climbing or indeed for climbing Everest. And the rules that we have for commercial expeditions is much more akin to saying people who are running 30,000 people in the London Marathon, for example, that is not the same as doing a trail run by yourself through the Pennines or the Alps. It's just ridiculous to compare them. And yet most of the people being critical of Everest, saying there's too many people, would never make that mistake of saying, oh, well, you shouldn't run through London 30,000 people because, you know, we should be alone and it's, you know. So I think that that's, I think I've made my point there, actually, haven't I?
I think you have. And tell us about those years you did. You know, you've made six ascents. Were you there willingly? Did you enjoy your ascents? Or as the actress said, was it just for the money? You know, were you there wishing that you'd rather be doing the more pioneering style of alpinism?
No, I do both. And I recognize they are completely different games. So when I'm working as a guide, my role is to help my clients achieve, you know, what they can as safely and as well as enjoyably as possible. My number one rule is that we all come back with our fingers and toes. But that's also my number one rule of climbing with my best friends.
So was your Everest climbs positive experiences for you personally?
Always, yeah. Yeah, very, very much so. One of the people I'd like to climb with is Ed on this podcast. We've rock climbed together and I'd dearly love to go on an expedition with him to see how difficult we find our, we are old friends. But I love climbing with my friends and I enjoy my work as well very much.
Was there anything on the mountain that that horrified you, or equally where you felt that the things are much better than they used to be?
The things changed in 2006 to make things slightly safer. Ed said that the mountain had got safer and safer. It's actually not strictly true. The fatality rate hovers between 1% and 2% and has done since 2006.
Yeah, it's changed a great deal in the commercial era, though. Since guided expeditions, it's improved considerably.
No, absolutely. I totally agree with you. If you look at the kind of private small teams doing difficult things, the fatality rate is much, much higher than in commercial world, Ed. The commercial world wouldn't be able to sustain.
No, I mean, it's bad for business, right?
Yeah. I mean, we rate very highly what people do in small teams in difficult mountains, but it's also very, very much more dangerous. and the fatality rate is higher. And the fatality rate of between 1% and 2% on Everest, it's kind of, it's what it's been since 2006. The big difference in 2006 was putting one Sherpa to one client on the summit day, not all the way up the mountain, but on summit day for the oxygen supply.
Young Hoon, and you, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah. So I just like to mention a couple of things with regard to the term commercialism. For example, like in terms, with, also with regard to the style of ascent. So I also joined in my first ascent alpine style expedition in 2013 in the autumn. There is a nearby Mount Everest. There is about 6,800 meters. The money we needed to pay to the outfitter based in Kathmandu was actually more than the money that we would need to pay to other comparable other mountains nearby, like Amada Balam or some other peaks. In other words, and also we hire less number of porters. In other words, the alpine style climbing, the high end, those like ascents that are well received in the elite alpinist world today, it can be said as highly commercialistic. And also it's socially ethically speaking, it's worse than the local economy, although it might not be the case that we want to address specifically today. Also the other thing is about the traffic jam. Tarkin, you mentioned about 2019, the Nirmal Purja's, the picture on the summit ridge of Mount Everest. The same thing happened in 2012 on the Mount Everest between Camp 3 and Camp 4. And the picture, the aerial picture of that became the headlines of the National Geographic, which received a lot of criticism. And I was in the middle of the line, the jam, and I know why that happened. That is organizational failure out of communication issues at the base camp. A lot of Sherpas there. They criticize the Western organized expedition. I would not say the name of the team, but they bailed out early May because they felt it's too dangerous. But they were actually commissioned to lead, to fix the rope up to the top. But they didn't complete that, nor they did let everyone else about their own decision to bail out. So the window, the climbing window for the top began only after 20th of May. So it was very short. So that's why the traffic jam of 3 days. So a lot of people had to climb on those just a few days. And that hence there are a few casualties. So as Victor said, it's not a lot of money out there. You know, Mount Everest is a huge mountain. And also, for example, Denali, you know, annually there are about over 1,000 people are climbing to the top. And Mount Everest, and some people even say Denali is actually a riskier mountain than Mount Everest. I'm not saying that Mount Everest is safer or because it's quite subjective depending on the levels or whatever. But what I'm saying is this is organizational failure. And then we need to look at the communication system. And that's related to what Ed mentioned about the bad management related to the government, because I would say it's the laissez-faire approach has been the norm on that mountain, that the especially those popular mountains in the spring season of Mount Everest and the spring and fall season of Manaslu, and in some part of Makalu in the spring season. While the other mountains are not that a lot of people are there still today, on those particular parts and time of the year, on particular areas of the slopes, there are laissez-faire approach has been implemented where no outside regulations, but Sherpas try to make more money, and the outfitters, they try to pay less salary, less wage to the jobs done by each Sherpas. So there are a lot of malpractices are going on between those Sherpas and outfitters. And there, for example, like the rescue mission, many Sherpas try to get that a job that because it got paid a lot compared to the
conditions. Have conditions broadly improved for Sherpas and porters over the years, Ed? It's always been a hot topic.
Yes and no, I would say. I mean, it's absolutely the case that Sherpa companies now dominate the market, and you know, they're good, their best people are earning decent whack by any standards. But there's still a great deal of exploitation. I mean, just returning to something Victor said about looking down the valley rather than up, you know, because the trekking industry has, you know, an exponentially greater impact in Nepal than the mountaineering industry. I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, the difficulty is the availability heuristic, right? The only thing anybody really knows about mountaineering, who knows nothing about mountaineering, is Mount Everest. And, you know, when you live in a country where, you know, with a coronation, it was presented as kind of some kind of heroic, epic achievement, you know, the new Elizabethans, et cetera, you know, teamwork and you know, working together to achieve a great goal. And then suddenly you're looking at people stuck in a queue and talks of garbage and so on and so forth, then people join the dots. It's ultimately not a very helpful way to look at it, but Everest has always demanded attention. And I, you know, Victor, you know, I can't disagree with Victor that the vast majority of people who are holding opinions about Everest will never go there. Unfortunately, it's under everybody's noses, and that's why it gets so much attention. But the you know, in terms of exploiting people, I think, you know, that's clearly appalling that happens, you know, in the interest, you know, I was there when very soon after that terrible avalanche a few years ago, and you know, that sense of exploitation was very palpable, and there was plenty of evidence as a consequence of that accident that, you know, what was going on was complicated. I mean, Yonghun Om will know more than I do about some of the sharp practices that go on traveling through the icefall, because he spent some time studying it in detail, but that kind of thing has to stop. The problem is, again, that the tourist ministry of Nepal doesn't understand mountaineering, has no interest in mountaineering, doesn't have the skill set to manage the mountain, and that would be done much better by probably the National Park Authority, run by Sherpas, who can sort of reach their community in a much more sensitive way. I mean, there's always that, you know, we talk constantly about the tensions between Western climbers and local people, but there's a real tension between local people and their government, and that's historical. And that never really gets discussed. And the way that the Sherpas, you know, can treat Rais and Tamangs, who do a lot of the grunt work further down the mountain, these are complicated issues. And, you know, you really want to hear from those people as well.
This is probably a good moment to mention the Mountain Worker Initiative. The MWI was set up by the UIAA after COVID to establish, disseminate and support guidelines for ethical trekking, mountaineering and company outfitters worldwide, beginning with a collaborative effort at Everest and throughout Nepal with the Nepal Mountaineering Association and Trekking Agencies Association of Nepal. Work is ongoing in defining the next steps for the project, but for more info and to donate, just search UIAA and Mountain Worker Initiative.
Hi, I'm Amit Chaudhary, UIAA Vice President, and I love mountain climbing, especially in the Himalaya, not only because you can make great and lasting friendships, learn skills of survival in the harshest environments, get the opportunity to see some of the most spectacular views you can imagine, test the limits of your endurance, but also because it helps you appreciate how insignificant you are in the larger scheme of nature. Hope you have fun climbing.
So how do we see things kind of evolving from here, for good or bad? Victor?
I'd like to pick up where Ed left off already, talking about conditions for the workers there. And of course, your mentioning of the MWI. There have been a number of very good charities that have tried to sort of redress some of the inequalities between the low altitude tribes like the Rais and Tamangs and the way they're treated. Porter's Progress jumps out immediately. And Ed will know a lot more about that than me. And also there's I mean, there's dozens of them. The ones that Ed and I know about are things like the Z Foundation, which works with people in more remote communities, helping with their farming practices. So, I think tighter control and of the way of where the money goes, that the porters and the lower echelon workers, the base camp staff, get properly paid and properly insured and treated with respect. I think both Ed and Young Hoon will say that's a slightly endemic problem in Nepal anyway. It's probably something that is like Brighton Rock. It goes right through the whole government system. One of the things that we're doing in Britain to try to help that is that we get grant money for expeditions from the Mount Everest Foundation. And one of the conditions of that is that we treat our local staff properly and make sure they're properly insured and properly paid and not overexploited.
I'd like to sort of broaden the topic out a little bit and bring in Young Hoon's experience here, if we may. Young Hoon, you spent 2 years living among Nepali. Can you share that experience? What were you doing and what did you observe?
Yeah, I stayed in Nepal with among the Sherpas who are not from Khumbu, but from Sankosaba district, which is to the east of Solukhumbu district. And sometimes they are called Makalo Sherpas, and they are really the second generation of the current contemporary, the most powerful groups of Sherpas. The Sherpas are not really the identical group of people. They share the term Sherpa as an ethnic title, but they are coming from different villages, and the village identity is the most important factor across the Nepali societies. So it's a kind of replacement of these social groups. The former groups, they are now going toward more lucrative positions or some other jobs. But now the next generation is coming. My point of view, my experience on the Mount Everest is that I've joined several expeditions for my research as well as for my own climbing. And I'm seeing how Sherpas are preparing, how Sherpas are perceiving and locating their experience on the mountain in the larger world, social and cultural world. And I think they enjoy it. And first of all, the climbing Mount Everest in this mass manner, because it's a socializing, first of all, for them. It's a good thing for them. They are enjoying them. You know, the solitary, small-scale alpine style exhibition is not fun at all for them. I mean, climbing together with a lot of people and talking and sharing with them and enjoying the moment of summit is a great thing. And as a guide, as well, of course, they feel a great satisfaction about when they are helping the novice to reach the top.
What about the sharp practices that Ed was talking
about? Yeah, practices. For example, like, you know, it's not just about the within the expedition organization, the employment practices, but it's widespread across the Nepali society. And people got paid about their salary. So sometimes there's a delay of the payment of the salary or the general reduction of the payment, promised the payment. And, you know, the Sherpas got the payment from their work, but it's the multiple categories are there, and daily wage and equipment fee and tips and summit tips and several categories are there, and they are paid in from different sources. And in order to make more money, Sherpas try to make a better connection and better and more connections than the company they are involved in. But on the other hand, the companies, they try to reduce the payment, the amount of the payment to the Sherpas. And so it is there is very a lot of social dynamics are going on there. But, you know, one thing that we need to talk about is the larger aspect of the Nepali society as a whole. There are a lot of problems are going on, such as poverty and inequality, violence and problem of democracy, and also the massive scale of migration. And also when we talk about the malpractices of the or the risk faced by the mountain workers, and several people actually die on the mountains annually. However, you know, annually and during the summer season, the lower plain areas, several hundred people, sometimes up to 1,000 people annually die because of the floods and the climate change stuff. You know, this kind of disproportionate attention to the mountain workers and mountain people itself is problematic, I guess, because, you know, it's out of the myth, the power of the myth of Mount Everest and other high mountains. So from mountaineers' point of view, is that really important to climb that high mountain? Is that really the maxim of the modern alpinism? As a mountaineer, I don't think so. I mean, where the place where I take part, I depart from the Victor's comment on the style of the climbing, the concept of difficulty has not been always the key stuff in modern alpinism. Some sort of the ascetic approach or mystic approach has also been important, and also some sort of the enjoyable experiences. For example, from my own cultural background in South Korea, difficulty is also a very important factor. But also, it's important to have a very good relationship with your own teammates, so that oftentimes they have the massive scale expeditions, because in itself it's just a fun thing. I mean, so therefore, what I'm saying is there can be several ways to climb Mount Everest. That's what we need to accept and admit. That number of the ways to climb mountain has been increasing. And who are there who are trying not to accept and admit this and argue for one thing? I mean, that's the cause, I guess.
What about other peaks? I mean, is Nepal still a magical place to go to climb other mountains in, for example, the 6,000 to 7,000 meter range? What's it like on other, the popular peaks such as Amar Dhar Lam? Are they also having the same issues that that Everest has with over bad management or over popularity? Victor, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I know Amar Dhar Lam relatively well. Climbed it about 8 times with clients, and yes, there are some problems with it. There's one area that's a camp one is difficult. Camp two is impossible. This is room for about 6 or 8 tents maximum, and it always smells of where people have dumped from. You know, so it's a pretty horrible place to go past. Having said that, what you said earlier is that, you know, are there other peaks? Yes, there's millions of peaks. If you want to get away from the crowds on the honeypot peaks, you only have to go a kilometer away often. You know, you can go a kilometer off the main trail and you're on mountains entirely by yourself. If you don't like it, if you don't like being in the social scene, which, you know, Young Hoon alludes to with the Sherpas, and it is very social. I mean, one of the things that what I completely agree with Young Hoon, I have to take. I don't think it's all about defining the difficulty of mountain. Okay. I think there are so many ways to climb every mountain that you know. I think they're all valuable in their own way, and each one is is setting the rules. So I know it's a bit of a rambling answer, but there's lots of fantastic peaks out there. And if you don't like it on Everest, or you don't like it on Amar Dhar Lam, or on, why don't you just go away and climb something that's unclimbed or very rarely visited? You have a lovely, lonely experience with you and your friends. And, you know.
But there is this new law, isn't there, in Nepal, that you now need to have a guide on every expedition. Isn't that right?
I think that Ed will confirm. I think at the moment it doesn't apply to the Sagarmatha National Park. I don't think it started this year in Sagarmatha. Last year it didn't apply to Sagarmatha. And it wasn't clear whether that applies to teams that already have a guide or a commercial leader from one of the. So it's also not completely clear to me how that is applied. It does mean that somebody going out on their own to climb Poon Hill or some minor thing in the Annapurna region has to officially hire a guide. But I think that the way they'll interpret that will be it'll be a nominated person from a trekking agency. So in the end, like so many things in Nepal, it's to do with boys' jobs for the boys. This actually brings us back to one of the things that's one of the big changes that's happened in the time that I've been guiding in because I started guiding in 96 and I'm kind of still guiding now a little bit. The big change in Everest and the big peaks was the transfer of control of the enterprises from foreign agencies to local ones. And I don't think Ed or Young Hoon will, I think you'll agree with me that it's actually, in principle, that's not a bad thing. It's just the way that it's sometimes implemented, and it's implemented in a slightly chaotic way sometimes.
Ed, what's your view currently for independent-minded climbers going to Nepal? Is it still a
matter? Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, Victor's absolutely right. I mean, I've been, over the last 15 years, I've been going to Western Nepal. You don't see anybody. It's fantastic. It's really wonderful. And, you know, I climb at a lower standard from Victor, but I mean, there
that's
are lots
not true. He's that's absolutely not true. I've only ever once in my life been able. I've only ever once in my life been able to burn head off on rocks.
But it's like it's old school mountain exploration. You know, like the last trip we went on, it was 10 days to base camp with mules, and I'm very grateful to the MEF that they supported that expedition because it made it financially viable for me to go, which is fabulous. But a lot of money went into the local economy, and it, you know, it was good. But as ever, I mean, it's a question of scale. I mean, I sort of agree with pretty much everything that Young Hoon was saying there, because mountaineering has such a high profile that people obsess about it too much. There are a million reasons to climb a mountain, and they're all self-indulgence in some shape or form. It's a part of tourism, you know. It's just a part of tourism. It's a business. And however you choose to practice it, there will be a business element within it. The key really is, you know, how workers' interests are protected in Nepal, because what happens on Everest is a workplace situation. I mean, the injuries that people suffer, the deaths people suffer, these are workplace accidents and they should be treated as such. And if you have, it is great that Nepali companies now sort of lead the charge in terms of organizing expeditions on Everest. But if there's no regulatory framework for that, then that's a problem. I mean, there is, but it's not properly enforced, it's not properly overseen, and it ought to be. I mean, one of the great tragedies about the 2016 disaster was the death of you know, one of the most able trades unionists in the icefall that year, which kind of took a little bit of the steam out of sort of improving workers' rights. But those are the kinds of areas that you want to be looking at. I mean, Nepal is losing its youth at the moment. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young people each year go abroad to work because there's insufficient employment. So in that sense, Everest is a success story because it ties a lot of, you know, it creates a lot of work. I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's something like, you know, for every tourist that arrives at Kathmandu Airport, it pins down about 7 jobs. So it's a great multiplier of labor. I mean, the Nepali tourism industry is actually quite small in comparison to some of its regional neighbors. It ought to be quite a bit bigger, but it's always struggled with the infrastructure for tourists.
I did read it was just under 7% that tourism contributes to GDP, according to the World Bank.
That's right. And I think it does, doesn't it? And most people think it's a great deal higher than that. And it's, you know, but it just shows you what the, you know, the power that tourism can have in sort of keeping people within the country. Because I promise you, pretty much every way that a Nepali gets a job, there will be an angle for somebody else. So when, you know, in order to get a job abroad, you have to pay somebody to get that job abroad. You know, they're all the way down the line. And then when you're sending money home, the government will take a little bit of that off you on its way through. No country ever developed itself through remittances. It's a terrible way to grow your economy. So anything that develops the Nepali economy in a sustainable way has got to be good.
Now, we're coming up to the end. We're starting to run out of time. But very quickly, Ed, I wondered if you could answer a question about the North. I did read that it was set to reopen this spring, having been closed for many years. Do you have any intel on that?
I don't have any intel on that. That's all I've read. It's interesting if that happens. I think Tibetan tourism will always be contingent on the political mood within Tibet. That mood has been worsening slightly recently with some of the demonstrations by ordinary Tibetans about Chinese development. So, you know, it's always a risk going to Tibet on holiday, because it has happened to lots of friends of mine. You arrive at the border and they've suddenly withdrawn your visa or your permit or whatever. Right. So, you know, I mean, it will reopen if it hasn't already. I'm sure it will. But it will always be a little more contingent than Nepal, which bent over backwards to stay in business during COVID. So, you know, it's unlikely that Nepal will take that kind of measure.
Before we go, any final comments from our guests here? Young Hoon, anything you wish to add before we go?
So how do you feel about the idea to change the name of Mount Everest to its original one, Chomolungma? If you think it's just okay and fine with it, then, you know, people are ready to go for the unknown mountains. But, you know, the power of the myth of the Mount Everest is still so high. Before we tackle it, I think the suggestion to climb the outside world and the unknown regions is still, you know, the people will not listen too much about it.
Well, answer that? Can I just say something to that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, because like I would love Mount Everest to be known by its original name. I totally would be on board for that. Chomolungma is a great name. It's a complicated name, has interesting cultural aspects which kind of introduce you to how people who live there actually feel about these mountains. So I love that, I thought, and I just know that it won't work. I would love for it to work, but I suspect that we will still be talking about Everest, you know, in 20 years' time. I'd love to be proved wrong. I really would. But just the way that human psychology works, getting that meme out of your head will just be too difficult, I suspect.
Victor?
I want to agree with everybody who's gone first, but I'm not sure I agree with it, Ed. Unusually, I usually find myself against my will agreeing with almost everything he says. People don't talk about McKinley anymore. They talk about Denali, and they think about Denali. I think, Ed, it's possible that, you know, that those sort of changes can come. And the way we refer to mountains or the names, it can be a marker for, you know, post-colonial practices and so on. But I think that in the end, respect for local cultures is not just contingent on a few words changing. It's to do with something a bit deeper, the way we treat people and their cultures. I would rather keep the name Everest and treat the people better than change the name to Chomolungma.
Okay. No, for sure.
That feels like an excellent place to leave it. I just want to add one little postscript to that viral photo story that I began with, the NIMS photo of the long queues up to Everest. I actually had a friend who was up there at the time, Nick Hollis, and he saw the way the wind was blowing, and with his guide, Pemba Sherpa, they decided to leave the day before in suboptimal conditions, and they hiked through the night, and they were breaking trail, and they had, from the South Col to the summit, the whole mountain to themselves, and an absolutely magical experience. So I guess the moral is you can make independent decisions up there too. So that's where we'll leave it. Thank you, everyone, to our guests, Victor Saunders, to Younghoon Oh, and to Ed Douglas. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed that fascinating discussion. And if you like this one, do check out our other podcasts on competition ice climbing and avalanche safety. And be sure to subscribe to Mountain Voices wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time. Mountain Voices is a podcast series from the International Climbing and Mountaineering Federation, presented and produced by Tarquin Cooper, co-produced by Peter Bourne, and edited by Tom Tushaw.